What committee? I'm here.
Subcommittee.
Just go ahead.
Okay. And I'll open up an informational session on climate change, and really pleased and honored to have our Secretary of State here to help kick off this auspicious informational hearing. So thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just want to give you a very condensed version of the climate change slideshow that I was trained to give by Al Gore late September, and went to Nashville and was trained by Mr. Gore, and about 50 of us spent a day and a half in the Gore family barn in Carthage, Tennessee, and he walked us through his slideshow and stood there with a scientist next to him and tried to answer all the questions of the people who were there. It was a fascinating group, I have to say. It was a former Miss America, several retired military folks from the Air Force, and a country and western singer by the name of singer-songwriter named Kathy Mattea, who you may know, who were all there. Since this time, he's trained about 1,000 people to present the slideshow. And here today is Sylvia Hayes from 3E Strategies. She was trained 2 months ago, in giving this slideshow. So I just want to talk to you very briefly about climate change. I want to talk to you about the situation we find ourselves in with our planet and what's happening here on the Earth with changes in the climate and in the atmosphere. And I think all of us know that the atmosphere is a very thin membrane around the Earth. And many people today still assume mistakenly that the Earth is so big that we humans cannot possibly have any major impact on the way our planet's ecological systems operate. And clearly, when you look at a picture like this, you realize that the most vulnerable part of the Earth's ecological system is the atmosphere. And it's vulnerable because it's so thin. Carl Sagan used to explain that if you had an orange covered with a coat of varnish, that would be about the same as the varnish would be about the same thickness as the Earth's atmosphere compared to the Earth. So let's just talk for a minute about the interaction between the Earth and the Sun and the atmosphere. We all know that light waves pass through the atmosphere, and many of those light waves are absorbed by the Earth and they warm the Earth, and some of those waves are radiated into space as in the form of infrared waves, and some infrared is trapped by the atmosphere and that warms the Earth even further. And this is a good thing, because it makes the Earth this amazing habitable place that we live on. Look at the solar system. And let me just put your attention, focus first on Venus. Venus is further from the Sun than Mercury, and yet Venus is more than twice as hot as Mercury. And the reason Venus is as hot as it is because it has an incredibly thick carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere that traps heat. Now, go further away from the Sun, go to Mars. Mars is, it's farther from the Sun than the Earth, but it's not that far from the Sun, and it's much colder. It's freezing on Mars, and the reason it's freezing on Mars is there's really no atmosphere on Mars, and so there's no heat trapping going on. Then come to the Earth, really the Goldilocks planet, never too cold, never too hot, always just right. We're really blessed to live on the Earth. But the reality is we can impact that balance. The atmosphere is thin enough that we're capable of changing its composition because of our industries, transportation, and cities. So let's go back to the atmosphere. As the atmosphere thickens with the output of all of our activities, that thicker atmosphere traps more infrared radiation, and we have global warming. And there are some real signs of change around the world of this increased temperature from global warming. Let's start in Africa. Mount Kilimanjaro in 1970. There's Mount Kilimanjaro in 2000, and there's Mount Kilimanjaro in 2005. Dramatic reduction in snowpack. There's a great song about the snows of Kilimanjaro that will not be very appropriate in the near future. Let's move to South America. Upsala Glacier, 1928. Same glacier, now a lake, in 2004. Let's move to this country. Glacier National Park, Boulder Glacier and Boulder and Glacier National Park. In 1932, you can see the tourists standing on the glacier. There's a picture from exactly the same location in 1988, where there's no longer a glacier. Boulder Glacier has receded. Scientists expect that by 2012, Glacier National Park will be a completely misnamed national park because there will be no glaciers. Mount Rainier. You can see there the white is the way the ice was in 1896, and the blue is the way the ice was in 1994. Significant receding of the glaciers on Mount Rainier. Mount Hood, White River Glacier, 1902, White River Glacier, 2001. And you see significant, this chart shows you the reduction on all the glaciers on Mount Hood. All of them are shrinking, some of them a lot, like 61% on White River Glacier, others not so significantly, like the Elliott Glacier at 19%. But all of them are getting smaller. This is a postcard that was produced in 1906 of the Hotel Belvedere in front of a glacier in the Alps. This is the Hotel Belvedere today, no longer a glacier in front of the hotel. Move to the Himalayas. This is a glacier in 1978, same glacier in 2004. Significant reduction in glaciers on the Himalayan plateau. You know, the Himalayan Plateau is a remarkable place that provides drinking water to a whole lot of people. The Indus River, the Ganges River, the Brahmaputra River, the Salween River, the Mekong River, the Yangtze River, and the Yellow River. All of these rivers provide drinking water to people. In fact, 40% of the world's population depends at least in part on the water coming from the Himalayan plateau. We're talking 3 billion people depend on this plateau for at least some of their drinking water. So as it shrinks, you start to threaten those people. Now, these folks spend all their time studying glaciers. They drill into glaciers to unlock the secrets that glaciers hold. And as you drill into a glacier, you find you can go back in time and you find little air bubbles. You can see in the reddish thing in front of the scientist there, you can see little air bubbles. There are trapped air bubbles that reveal what the atmosphere was like in times gone by. And as you drill in, you can really figure out, go back, way back in time, to find out. You can see the layers, annual layers, like tree rings. That's what you find when you drill into a glacier, is you find, you can go back in time, you can count back in time. So they've been able to do, in Antarctica, they've been able to drill into the glaciers to find out what our atmosphere was like for the last 650,000 years. 650,000 years. This is the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere for the last 650,000 years. It never got above 300 parts per million in the last 650,000 years. It's very interesting. If you look at temperature, which you can also tell from the air samples that you take out of the glacier, temperature follows very closely with the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. And just to give you a perspective, if you look at the far right-hand side of the temperature, the high point, that's like temperature it is today in New York City. Then you look at the low point on the far right side, that would be New York City with 2 miles of snow and ice over your head. So dramatic differences in temperature that you see there. You can track all six ice ages that occurred in those 650,000 years from those charts. But where are we today with CO2? Where we are today is 383 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide has never been this high in the last 650,000 years. And where are we projected to go if we just keep doing things business as usual? Where we're projected to go in the next 45 years is to almost 600 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Nobody can tell you for sure what that means, but there are already pretty clear signs that the temperature is following the CO2. The hottest 10 years on record have occurred in the last 16 years. The hottest year on record was 2005. And not surprisingly, you're seeing more warmth on the land, but you're also seeing more warmth on the surface of the ocean. And you're seeing a dramatic, this is what you'd predict is a normal variability on the temperature of the surface of the ocean. And this is what scientists project is going to, the surface of the ocean, the warming of the surface of the ocean based on more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and hence more global warming. So the green is a computer projection of warming, and this is the actual. That's the actual temperature increase, and you can see it very closely is following the projected temperature increase. Now, what difference does it make? We're only talking about 0.3 degree average increase in temperature in the surface of the ocean. Big deal. Well, that's the difference it makes. The warmer the ocean, the surface of the ocean gets, the more significant and damaging hurricanes become. Best example, basically MIT looked at this and said we've seen a 50% increase in duration and intensity of storms since the 1970s based on the fact that the ocean surface is getting warmer. I think all of us remember Hurricane Katrina. It was an incredible example where as water temperature went up, the wind velocity goes up, and the storm moisture content, the wallop of the storm, went up as well. So they just track directly with each other. This is a satellite photo of Katrina. It's crossing Florida right now. It's a Category 1 storm. Watch as it gets over the warmer Gulf water. It just becomes an incredibly powerful storm and slams into New Orleans. And I think all of us remember the destruction that is really still being dealt with in New Orleans from Katrina. But what's so interesting is that the issue here with weather damage is it's really not just Katrina. Look at the chart there. The number of weather and flood catastrophes in how much money has been lost in the last decade? Incredible increase, and it's been climbing ever since the 1980s. And the same thing's true in Europe. This was a flash flood in Switzerland, and you're seeing a dramatic increase in major flood events in Europe. This is a normal morning in Switzerland. And go to Mumbai, India. You're having the same kind of thing. 37 inches of rain in 24 hours. Think about that. 37 inches of rain in 24 hours. 1,000 people died. This is rush hour the next day in Mumbai, India. You're seeing dramatic increase in flood events in Asia, just as you saw in Europe and as you saw in the Americas. Flash flood in the Sichuan province of China, family saving their kid in the bath bucket. But right next door in Anhui province, in very near Sichuan province in China, not record floods, but record drying. And you're seeing incredible drying and cracking of the soil because of the climate change. And one of the things that's so, I think, just hard to kind of get our heads around is that the global climate is not a linear straight line system. It's a very non-linear system that's all interconnected, But it's not just going to move one way or the other. And this is the chart that shows the increase in rainfall in some parts of the world and the increase in drying in other parts of the world. You can see up to a 50% increase in rainfall in some places, the bigger the raindrop, and up to a 50% increase in drying in other places, the bigger the X. So it's really, I mean, it really is appropriate to call it climate change. Because that's what's going on all over the world, is significant variations in the climate model. One of the best places to look that's a little scary is Lake Chad, the Darfur region in Africa. Lake Chad has changed in size a lot over the last century, gotten bigger and smaller, but it's never before disappeared like it has now. And this is Lake Chad today. It's pretty tough for the families that live on Lake Chad in the Darfur region, who used to fish to support their families or used to irrigate crops to support their family. It's pretty tough for them now. And we all are just painfully aware of the genocide that's going on in the Darfur region. And it's not all because of climate change, but it's clearly had some relationship to the fact that people can't support their families anymore. And there's all kinds of civil unrest. Look at the United States for a minute. This is the chart that shows the reduction in summer, June to August, summer soil moisture content, with the doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Basically, you got about 35% reduction in soil moisture in the entire breadbasket of America. Now, this chart shows if there's a quadrupling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it shows that there's a 50 to 60% reduction in soil moisture in the breadbasket of America. I haven't talked to too many farmers who say they can raise the same crops they're raising today, whether it be corn or soybeans or wheat, with 50 to 60% less moisture in the soil. So it's a scary proposition. This is a chart that basically talks about changes in the Northwest. It talks about more heat and more rain. The map on the left shows how many additional days we'll have the hottest weather. We'll get more days of the hottest weather. It's anticipated the Northwest will see a doubling of such sweltering days. So if you remember the five hottest days last summer, you can expect 10 of those hot days in the future. On the right, you see more rain. Warming injects more moisture into the air, hence more intense rain and snow in our forecast. Fires. We're all aware that there have been a significant, dramatic increase in forest fires. Last August, end of August, 82 large wildfires were burning all over the Northwest and down into California and as far away as Texas. Significant increase in wildfires. And I think all of us are real aware that wildfires destroy the timber value. Wildfires destroy the ecological values. Wildfires destroy the water that comes from these lands. They're very devastating. And it's very interesting if you track the temperature of the West, the average temperature of the West, and track fires. Average temperature of the West has gone from, in the 1970s, about 57 degrees. It's now, in 2000, 2002, it's about 59 degrees. And look at the number of major wildfires that track very directly with the increase in temperature. And we all understand why. The forest fuels on the floor, and the hotter it gets, the drier it gets, the more it burns. It's real simple, but it's a pretty direct relationship as the forest warms. And you're seeing that in, this is the Americas. This is South America and North America. You're seeing a dramatic increase in this decade. This is Africa. You're seeing a dramatic increase in this last decade. This is Oceania, which is Australia and New Zealand, seeing a dramatic increase in forest fires and damage. Now, these trees aren't forest fire damaged trees. These trees are called drunken trees. And they're just splayed all over the place because, in fact, they're like drunks. They can't stand up straight because they're rooted in permafrost. And as the permafrost thaws, basically the trees can't stand up straight anymore. So they just wobble all over the place. This is an apartment building in Siberia that has its foundation in the permafrost that no longer has any foundation at all. And this is some scientific studies have been done about measuring the temperature in boreholes. And starting in the 60s, they bored into the permafrost to see what the average temperature was. It was -3.5 degrees centigrade. And then by 2000, the temperature was -1 degree centigrade. So the permafrost is clearly warming. And basically scientists say we're headed for an ecological landslide if the permafrost actually just thoroughly, completely melts. So right now you have about 730 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere. And if you look at the permafrost region of Alaska and Siberia, and if that region actually starts to warm and melt, you'll see a huge increase in carbon in the atmosphere. Scientists expect the carbon in the atmosphere to double because of permafrost melting. Now, you might say, well, why? Well, because there's all this organic matter in the permafrost that's right now frozen, not rotting, just frozen. And as it thaws, it rots, and it puts all kinds of carbon into the atmosphere. So dramatic creates a dramatic problem of more carbon in the atmosphere. Now, when you look at the Earth, you recognize that the sun warms the equators much more than the poles, and there's a lot of effort, natural effort by the Earth to shift the heat from the equator to the poles, and that leads to wind patterns, that leads to ocean currents that are all involved with moving heat from the equator to the poles. Average temperature of the Earth today is 59 degrees Fahrenheit. If you have a 5-degree increase in the average temperature of the Earth, if you think about this, with a 5-degree increase in the average temperature, it's not a linear system here. You get 1-degree increase at the equator. That equals a 12-degree increase at the poles. So you get more thawing and more heat in the frozen areas as the Earth warms up. And what it does to the wind patterns and the ocean currents is completely unknown and unpredictable. One really good example of that, a change in wind patterns, is what's called the ocean dead zone that we experienced off the central Oregon coast. Basically, the coast experienced its most severe dead zone in recorded history during the summer of 2006. The dead zone is dead because of extremely low oxygen in the water, too low to support plants or animals. Now, scientists like oceanographer Jane Lipchenko from Oregon State University are very quick to point out that they cannot make a definitive connection to climate change. But dead zones are caused by changes in wind patterns. And changes in wind patterns are consistent with predictions of climate change. And I want to show you a little video that an OSU remote submarine took at about 65 meters off the coast. This is healthy ocean, just looking great. And then we get to the dead zone event, the hypoxic event. This is what the floor of the ocean looked like. And basically you have particularly a lot of dead crabs on the floor of the ocean because crabs can't move ahead of the low oxygen water, can't seek the higher oxygen water. They're just pretty much stuck and they just die on the floor of the ocean. Now, another issue of real concern to me is and certainly Jacqueline Dingfelder has shared, that Madam Chair has shared this as well, is the fate of salmon. And as the climate warms, these charts show that larger and larger areas, the dark areas, the black areas, become inhospitable to salmon. So that basically by 2040, we're expecting the Snake River, the Yakima River, parts of the Willamette River, and the Rogue River to be inhospitable for salmon, because they'll be too warm. Now, one of the things that warming does is it changes, it moves the seasons. And you see a shift in seasons in Switzerland, for example, number of days where there's frost on the ground has gone down from about 60 days in 1900 to about 4 days in 2000. And what has that meant where they get the winter gets milder? What it's meant is a dramatic increase in invasive species in Switzerland. The best example for us is the western pine beetle. The western pine beetle is infecting 14 million acres of timber in British Columbia and southeast Alaska. And the reason it's infecting that timber is because it can survive the winter now. And it can stay and breed and do very well and make trees very, very unhealthy and die. So you're seeing a significant western pine beetle damage from the warming of the winters. This is a chart from the Oregonian about how much frost there is in the Willamette Valley. There are fewer days of frost in McMinnville in the northern Willamette Valley. The number of frost days has climbed steadily to about one-third of the 1950s levels. And this is a chart that shows snowpack. And the little black areas on the left side of each chart are the Cascades in Oregon and Washington. And warming is going to mean less snow, particularly at mid-elevations in the Cascades. It's estimated the April 1st snowpack will be 44% smaller in 2040 and 55% less in 2060. Now, I think all of us know how much we depend on snowpack for a whole bunch of things, whether it be summer irrigation, whether it be winter recreation, whether it be summer whitewater rafting, whatever it is, we all depend in large part on snowpack. Now, the other thing that's so interesting is that you're going to see a dramatic impact on what grapes grow well where. I think all of us know that Pinot Noir is really the Oregon signature grape. And one of the things that makes Pinot Noir as good as it is it loves cool nights. And Pinot Noir will move north by the end of the century due to rising temperatures. And you can look at the chart and see where Pinot Noir goes. It's no longer in Yamhill and Washington County, folks. It's basically on the coasts of Washington and Oregon. Who would have ever thought that the coast would be prime Pinot territory? Sorry, I just never thought of it that way. Now, look at less delicate grapes. Less delicate grapes that now grow in California will move mostly to the Northwest. I point this out to you because this is actually a very significant economic opportunity for us. There's going to be no wine industry virtually in California, but there is going to be a lot of potential for growing grapes in Oregon and Washington. I have to say that I never thought Olympia would be better known for wine than beer. But that seems to be where we're headed. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out with a report about impacts recently. And they said that you can expect a 3 to 4 degree warming of the planet, Fahrenheit warming of the planet. It's really already locked in with the amount of carbon we've put into the atmosphere. And that's likely to put up to 20% of the plants, animals, and other creatures of the Earth at risk of extinction. So that's just pretty well locked in, that 20%. But if we do nothing, if we just keep a business-as-usual attitude, basically the IPCC says that you're going to see a 6-degree Fahrenheit increase. And that threatens half of creation. We're not talking about minor impacts here. We're talking about half of creation dies with a 6%. A 6-degree increase. This means that we have, in the next few years, the opportunity and responsibility to save 1 out of 3 species now inhabiting the planet. And I have to tell you, time is not our friend. So, let me just very quickly, I want to go through just that there's been a real change on the part of the business community. This is Paul Anderson, the CEO of Duke Energy, a large utility on the East Coast. He says, I really feel the time has come to act. I really support mandatory carbon controls. There was an amazing press conference about 4 months ago by the CEOs of 10 of the largest American corporations saying, we favor mandatory controls. We think it's critical that we implement carbon caps now. And we're talking about people that aren't really clean industries. We're talking about Alcoa, talking about General Electric, British Petroleum, DuPont, Duke Energy, Caterpillar, PG&E Corporation. All of these CEOs basically came together and said, we've got to deal with this global warming and carbon problem. You also, even Walmart. Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart, said, you know, science used to be controversial about this global warming stuff, but he really believes that everybody's got to work together to reduce greenhouse gases as quickly as we can. So the business community has really recognized that their survival and our survival are tied very directly to dealing with carbon and greenhouse gases. People all over the world have recognized it and ratified the Kyoto Treaty, and there are only two industrialized countries that didn't ratify it. We're proud to be sitting in one of them, and the other is Australia. Those two countries didn't ratify, but there have been amazing efforts, and we're one of the states that has taken it. There have been amazing efforts around the country, in spite of the United States not signing the Kyoto Treaty, to deal with greenhouse gases. You've got a coalition of nine East Coast states that are all working together to reduce carbon output, and you've got a significant effort by Washington, Oregon, and California that's now been joined by New Mexico and Arizona. So you now have the fifth largest country in the world is represented by those five western states. They've now joined together to say we're going to do what we can to reduce greenhouse pollution in our country. So it's a dramatic, real dramatic effort. And you also see cities supporting the Kyoto Protocol. And there have been cities, Portland, Lake Oswego, Corvallis, Eugene, Ashland, have all signed the Kyoto Protocol and said we want to do what we can to reduce our carbon contribution. Portland got written up in the New York Times recently for the work that they'd done. And, you know, the New York Times article said Portland has achieved stunning reductions in carbon pollution, and they're below the requirements of the Kyoto Protocol. They've managed to do that while their economy is still booming. So basically, it's real clear that we don't have to sacrifice a good economy to make progress on global warming. We do have to be smart, and we do have to have resolve to deal with it. And, you know, I'm just reminded of the Chinese character for crisis. Obviously, there's a crisis with global warming, and the character for crisis is made up of two separate characters. One is danger, and the other is opportunity. And clearly we know what the danger is. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has made that painfully clear to us. Six degree Fahrenheit increase, a half of creation extinct. That's the danger. The opportunity that we have with global warming is all the things that are going on in this legislature today and are being talked about with renewable energy development, with biofuels development, with green building efforts, and with carbon capture and storage with forestry. There's just all those efforts that we can participate in as a society, as a state, and really do incredibly well by it and serve our people well, both in the rural areas and the urban areas, but also reduce our carbon contribution. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I think you're better than Al Gore personally, but. Any questions for the Secretary of State?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure. I'm
excellent.
I'll sit here and strike my set. Okay?
Sure, no problem. Okay. Next, I'm going to call up David Bantoff from the governor's office, and he's going to provide an overview of the governor's climate change initiative. And colleagues, just to let you know, since we started about 15 minutes late, we'll go till 8:15. So I'm going to ask everybody to try to keep on the schedule we talked to, because I know it's been a long day and everyone's very tired. And Mr. Greeny, you did move from your seat. You were there for several hours.
Chairs Dinkfelder, Novakian, and members of your respective committees, or I guess Representative Dinkfelder's respective committee at this point. My name is Dave Antoff, and I'm the Sustainability Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski, and Mike Greeny from the Department of Energy has come up as well and is here to help me answer any questions that may come from the panel or from the committee. And after that presentation of kind of what the issue is and why we need to be dealing with climate change, I'm going to give you just a real brief overview of kind of what the governor's been doing for the past several years to try and take initial steps towards combating global warming. And then there's going to be a panel of folks coming forward that will talk in more detail about what some of the work groups have done over the past 3 years. But addressing climate change and providing leadership on the issue in the region and nationally has been a priority issue for the governor since he took office. In 2003, the governor worked with his fellow governors from Washington and California to create a regional dialogue on climate change. That three-state initiative was the first of its kind in the West and has now grown, as Secretary of State Bradbury mentioned, to five states this year with the addition of New Mexico and Arizona. The initiative calls for the development of a region-wide greenhouse gas reduction goal as well as market-based system to achieve those reductions. We hope that several more states, as well as British Columbia and other Canadian provinces, will join into this initiative this year. You'll hear testimony, as I said, tonight from several members of the governor's prior work groups that have assisted in developing policy around climate change. I also want to just kind of point out the incredible work that the Department of Energy has done over the past 3 years in essentially staffing all these work groups. Both Mike and his staff have put in just a ton of hours and work in trying to move these processes forward, and we're really just very lucky to have that kind of assistance. In 2004, the governor appointed a global warming advisory group to develop an assessment of climate change in Oregon and recommendations for how Oregon can reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. Again, it was the first statewide group of its kind in the West, and Gail Ackerman is going to talk a bit more about that group and its report. In 2005, the governor began implementing key recommendations from the advisory group, including the announcement of greenhouse gas reduction goals for Oregon and implementation of the Clean Cars Program for Oregon. In 2006, the governor appointed a carbon allocation work group to assess the feasibility and possible design for a cap-and-trade system in Oregon. Angus Duncan is going to talk more about what that group did over the past year. And he also appointed a climate change integration group to continue the work of the prior Global Warming Advisory Group, as well as to develop a new assessment and report on how Oregon should begin to prepare for adapting to the adverse impacts that will be caused by climate change to our long-term planning and infrastructure in Oregon. And Mark Abbott is going to testify to the work of the Climate Change Integration Group a bit for you as well. Elements of all three of the work group recommendations are before you this session, both in the energy legislation you already have been considering in your respective committees and in the climate change bills that will be considered next week. Some of you participated in a roundtable on climate change that the governor convened this year in January. At the roundtable, the governor received feedback from the chairs of the three work groups that we just mentioned. He also challenged the legislature at the roundtable to take a serious look at climate change bills this session, and he applauds your committees for doing so. At the roundtable, the governor also laid out several of the themes that have driven his policy agenda in this arena, and they include that the science supporting the need for urgent action to combat climate change is now clear and compelling, that it also is clear to the governor, as it is for an ever-growing number of Oregonians and Americans, that the only viable pathway for this state and this nation is to move aggressively forward in combating global warming, investing in and diversifying our renewable energy sources, and transitioning to an energy economy not relying on fossil fuels. and that this is an opportunity for Oregon to lead, not just to follow, to get ahead and not to fall behind, and to create a new energy economy, not just trail in its wake. Both of your committees have done excellent work already this session in moving important energy legislation. The biofuels bill and the business energy and residential energy tax credit bills that already passed out of the House and the renewable energy standard that already passed out of the Senate, both with bipartisan support, are major steps forward in the fight to combat global warming, as well as a pathway to huge economic opportunity in Oregon going forward. The governor hopes those bills can pass out of their remaining chambers and reach his desk as soon as possible. But your work will not be done then. The governor also hopes that you will pass one or more of the significant climate change bills that you are now taking up. The time is now for this legislature to show that it is ready to work with the governor to take on broader climate change issues. It cannot and will not all be accomplished this session. It may take many sessions to adequately address the range of issues that will need to be addressed to achieve the greenhouse gas reductions necessary to stabilize our climate. But now is the time to start down that road, and a significant first step, in addition to the steps already being taken on energy legislation, is very important. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this evening.
Great, thank you. And David, do you want to add anything, Mr. Rainey?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, Mike Rainey from the Department of Energy. Just very briefly, during our budget hearings we had earlier this year, we talked about the benchmarks, and one of the benchmarks is to maintain CO2 levels per capita at 1990 levels. And in fact, since 1990, we have been on an ever upward course, both total emissions of CO2 and per capita emissions, in spite of the efforts we've taken on energy efficiency and renewable energy, which are some of the best in the country. Global Warming Governor's Advisory Committee final report that you'll hear more about later this evening has a chart in it that shows this pattern, this trend going upward. And it shows each of the measures and the types of measures that it takes to turn that around, to start going downward. We have a long way to go to the levelized, the 1990 levels, and even further to reach the Kyoto targets that are below 1990 levels. But the legislation that Dave mentioned that you've passed so far, and the measures that you'll hear more about tonight, the cap and trade legislation, the Climate Change Integration Act, and the plant performance measure, are all needed in addition to these other measures. Additional measures are needed to help us get on this downward course and to reach the long-term goals of 10% below 1990 levels by the year 2020, and 75% below by 2050, a level that and the international scientists recommend for the long-term stability of the planet. So the need is very great, and the challenge is great, and thank you for the opportunity to present this information this evening.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. And stick around in case there's any questions. Okay. I'm going to call up Gail Achterman, who's going to provide an overview of the Global Warming Advisory Work Group and report. And does Mark want to come up with you?
Why doesn't he do that?
Yeah, then? Since we're sort of stressed for time.
Yeah,
that would be great. Faster. And for the record, please make sure and state your name.
Chair Dingfelder, Chair of Achterman, thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I'm Gail Achterman, the Director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University. And I had the pleasure of serving on the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming during 2004. Copies of the group's full report have been provided to you, and I'm just going to provide some highlights, a briefing about the group and its recommendations to hopefully inform your consideration of the climate change legislation that you're going to have before your committees. I think it's important to understand the process and principles under which the advisory group worked. And those processes and principles were developed by a very diverse group of over 20 individuals. There were scientists on the panel, but there were also folks like me that really had no prior exposure to climate change scientists. There were ranchers, farmers, foresters, transportation industry executives, utility executives, and we all really got an education together about climate change and its implications for our state. The group was co-chaired by Dr. Jane Lubchenco from Oregon State University and Mr. Mark Dodson of Northwest Natural, and both of them extend their apologies to you. They both had other commitments because your hearing date kept changing. We kept hopping around, not being able to meet their schedule. So I'm the rather inadequate substitute for the two of them. The charge, as David Vantoff mentioned, from the governor was for this group to develop a climate change strategy for Oregon, and the guiding principle was that it should be a strategy that would provide long-term sustainability by both protecting environmental and public health and creating economic opportunity. So that was what our charge was from the governor. And we agreed on the principles to guide our work, which were, if we were going to do this, we needed to set real measurable targets, goals to achieve in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions that were commensurate with our contribution to the problem. Second, we needed to look at cost-effective solutions for Oregon. Third, that we really wanted to do this in a way that would create opportunities for investment and economic development in Oregon. And a really fundamental thing was that as we embarked on this, that we not impair energy reliability in the state. We didn't want to sacrifice our energy supplies while we did this. We got terrific support from a lot of different state agencies and private organizations who participated in the preparation of very detailed white papers on the greenhouse gas emissions sector by sector in Oregon and developing proposed actions to actually reduce emissions in each one of those sectors. And by December 2004, after less than a year of work, even though we had this incredibly diverse group of people, their biographies are all in the back of the full report, there was a unanimous vote to adopt the report and the recommendation for action and this strategy for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. An important underpinning for why we got to that point was a conference that the Institute for Natural Resources put together with funding from Dean Abbott and Dean Bloomer at Oregon State, a science conference in June 2004, which attracted over 65 scientists mostly, there were a few of us non-scientists there, to really prepare a consensus statement on the impacts of climate change in the Pacific Northwest as best that they could tell us, so that that scientific consensus statement could guide the work of the advisory group. And the consensus statement is included as an appendix to the report. The full statement is there. And if you have questions on the science, you should ask Dr. Abbott. I can do the very Reader's Digest version of it, but Dr. Abbott can answer any questions you have about the science. The key for me as a non-scientist on the advisory group, not really having tracked any of this before I served on the group, is that I came away with this sense of overwhelming scientific agreement on the fact that climate change is happening, and the documentation is based on real observed change, not modeling results. The scientists are convinced that human activities are a major causal factor for this change. In other words, we can really do something about this, that it's not just something that nature is doing. We are very much a part of nature and part of the changes that are driving climate change. And third, that climate change is going to have very serious impacts in Oregon, and that we need to really start talking about and addressing. So it was an eye-opener for me participating in the science conference and on the advisory group. The goals that the advisory group recommended that the state adopt have already been articulated by Mr. Vantoff, and I won't repeat them, but those goals provide a pathway to climate stabilization in Oregon that will get us, hopefully, by 2050, quite a long time from now, but time's passing, to a climate stabilization level of 75% below the 1990 levels of greenhouse gases. The report has a very detailed list of recommended actions. The critical actions that we need to take as a society are related to electrical energy generation, because that's 42% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions are from electric energy generation, and from the transportation sector, because 38% of the emissions are attributable to motor vehicles of one kind or another. So you've already are very aware of some of the actions that have already been taken since 2004 with the Environmental Quality Commission adoption of a tailpipe emission standard. You're considering as a legislative body some other very important actions on energy sources. The Department of Forestry and the Department of Agriculture are working hard on increasing biological sequestration measures. But one of the things that I want to leave you with is the importance of the new legislative measures that you are going to be considering, I understand, in your committees, particularly HB 3543. Because HB 3543 would permanently establish a commission to coordinate and track this action plan. It's really hard when you have so many different agencies involved. If you don't have one body that's keeping track of who's doing what, it's really hard to carry out your strategy, whether it's voluntary or regulatory or anything else. So that commission is critically important. And the second thing is to create a new Climate Change Research Institute to address the very long list of unknowns about the impacts of climate change in Oregon. I'm a member, as many of you know, of the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I've got a lot of questions as a commissioner who's spending taxpayers' gas tax money on what kind of long-range capital investments. Our capital investments are 50-year investments. If we're going to be making those kinds of investments in Highway 101, I'd like to know what the effect of climate change is going to be, whether it's sea level rise or storm events or whatever, so that I'm not spending those dollars on capital investments that are going to wash into the ocean. So we really need much more refined analysis, not just for the Oregon Department of Transportation to analyze climate change impacts, but for every water utility in the state, for every landowner who has road systems that depend on culverts, whether you're a timber company or a farmer. We've got a lot of unanswered questions that we need to answer in order to help Oregonians plan for the future in a changing climate world. Thank you.
Thank you, okay. Dale. Mark?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and Chair Avakian and members of the respective committees. My name is Mark Abbott. I'm the Dean of the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. I'm also the co-chair of the Climate Change Integration Group. Ned Dempsey, president of Century West Engineering, is the other co-chair. You also have copies of my written testimony, but I'll just try and summarize it here. Gales and Secretary Bradbury have done a nice job of setting the context for our group, but I thought I'd just start just to remind you again that the world is really on the precipice of a whole series of major changes in our atmosphere, ocean, and land, and that without strong actions, our children and our grandchildren will witness an Earth with levels of carbon dioxide that actually have not been seen in 20 million years, far longer than what Secretary Bradbury put forward. But we're looking at levels that really are unprecedented, and we're not sure what kind of planet we're going to see. But we do know that these changes are going to affect Oregon's forests, oceans, its economy, and her people. But we also believe that we can seize the opportunities presented by this crisis, creating new energy-producing technologies, enacting sustainable practices, developing scientific and education leadership, and investing in our infrastructure, all to reduce our carbon emissions as well as to prepare for Oregon for the impacts of a warmer planet. The Climate Change Integration Group engaged the public and private sectors, researchers, business leaders, and private citizens to begin to develop these public policies and private initiatives to respond to the challenges of climate change. And you have a list of the membership and can see the diversity of that group. We were charged by Governor Kulongoski with four tasks: to develop a toolbox of options for curbing and coping with climate change, continuing the assessment of the sensitivity, adaptive capacity, and vulnerability of the natural and human systems to climate change, initiate and support research aimed at identifying opportunities and strategies for both preparation and mitigation, and to provide an opportunity for education for Oregonians. The Climate Change Integration Group has met 7 times since its formation in mid-2006, and we've received several formal presentations from climate scientists, business sectors, state and federal agencies concerning climate change and its projected impacts. And all of the meetings and the material are available on the Oregon Department of Energy website. We delivered our interim report last January to Governor Kulongoski, and that report is also available on the website. And it highlighted the following actions. One, which was to make permanent the goals in the Oregon strategy on greenhouse gas reductions and continually revise and evaluate those goals as the science improves. Establish a permanent body to develop and evaluate our strategy to mitigate and to adapt to climate change. Establish a comprehensive research center in Oregon. Continue to expand our partnerships with local governments as well as with other states and with federal agencies to develop regional and federal policies. Develop an assessment of the impacts of climate change on Oregon's economy as well as on its public health, and to continue to explore policies for carbon allocation and trading. Many of these actions, as Gail has mentioned, have been incorporated into pieces of legislation that your committees will hear in the coming week. And in particular, the goals for carbon emission reduction, the establishment of a permanent body to develop and evaluate Oregon's climate strategy, and a new research center are in there, and the Climate Change Integration Group strongly supports these efforts. I might add to what Gail mentioned about the Climate Research Institute, being a scientist, that this is something that would be within the Oregon University system. And we envision it as not just a research center, that it's actually going to be really a conduit between the state agencies, the private sector, and the public to understand the current state of knowledge about the sensitivity, adaptive capacity, and vulnerability of both natural and human systems to climate change in Oregon. So that we need, as scientists, to understand what are the drivers that affect federal and regional and local agencies, what are the business opportunities. So, for example, one of the drivers that is projected in climate change, as Secretary Bradbury mentioned, was increasing frequency of hurricanes, perhaps on the Gulf Coast. How is that going to affect human migration patterns into more benign climates like Oregon, and how, for example, should the Portland metropolitan area do engage that kind of information in its long-term planning for land use, for transportation infrastructure, for housing, etc.? It's that kind of secondary impact of climate change and how people react to climate change and change their behaviors that are really at the cutting edge of science that we see this institute playing a key role. We see that there are enormous opportunities both for federal and private funding to develop and support such an institute and really put Oregon at the national forefront for that type of research. And it would coordinate and integrate the very capable but at present dispersed capabilities within the Oregon University system and really put us in the lead. The future work for the Climate Change Integration Group is to deliver its final report at the end of this calendar year. We are going to look at the allocation and mitigation of carbon emissions, particularly look at economic development strategies, and also look more closely at the role of land use planning and the transportation sector in both mitigation and preparation for climate change, as Gail mentioned a few minutes ago. Second, we're going to look at adaptation and preparation for climate change by identifying the high-risk aspects of climate and its impacts on what we're going to call the built, the natural, and human environments, and where are the vulnerabilities and how can we reduce those. The next part of our report will look at an education and communication strategy, particularly focusing on how can we bring the impacts of climate change down to the local scale, so that people really can see how it affects them. It's kind of hard to get your arms around global average temperature, but it's a little easier to understand changes in frost-free days in your region and how it's going to impact the kind of crops that you can grow. And lastly, we're going to develop suggestions for a research agenda within the Oregon University system. And to summarize, just want to end with these last few sentences, that we really do believe within the broad range of not only the academic community, but private citizens, the business community, and many government agencies, that our continued
prosperity, and our Oregon heritage of environmental stewardship demand that we begin this journey now. The road is long and the route is complex, and there's simply no easy solutions, but we cannot wait for an uncertain future to make itself manifest. We owe it to Oregon and to our children and our grandchildren to begin this work, and we'd appreciate any input or direction you'd like to provide. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Gail. Appreciate it. Are there any questions for either Gail or Dean? Excellent. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And last, I'm going to call up, actually, together, I'm going to call up Angus Duncan and Bob Doppelt. Why don't you both come up and make sure and introduce yourselves for the record. Thank you, gentlemen, and we apologize again about the delay.
Representative Dinkfelder, Senator Avakian, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Angus Duncan. I was a member of the Governor's Advisory Group, along with Gail and Bill and many other distinguished Oregonians. And with Gail, I served on the drafting committee that got to do a lot of the writing of that document. And then ended up also being appointed to the Governor's Carbon Allocation Task Force and chaired the drafting committee for that process as well. Long slog through most of last year, many meetings, pretty technical stuff, but a product I think we're all pretty proud of at the end of the day. I'm also a former member and chair of the Northwest Power Planning Council, and so the utility side of this problem is the side that that I probably have the greatest interest in and hope I can make the greatest contribution. I would also like to add my commendations for the work of ODO staff in supporting all of these processes on a shoestring and very few people and a lot of extremely high-quality work. Madam Chair, I'm also president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, which is a rapidly growing 8-year-old, about $6 million a year, nonprofit business and foundation. We buy and sell renewable energy credits across the country, really originated that product nationally. We also develop renewable energy projects from small solar for schools to a 200-megawatt wind project that's going to start turning the end of this year. We're a member of the Oregon Business Association. We are a member of E2, which is a national association of business leaders, and I have been asked by E2 to convey a letter from a number of the Oregon members to you, and I think that either has been handed out or will be shortly. So the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming in 2004 in our report unanimously recommended both the targets and a 70-measure strategy for achieving them. And we also adopted 10 principles, which in the interest of time, I'm going to boil down to two. They are, first, follow the science, and secondly, achieve the reductions that the science tells us we have to achieve in the most sensible economic ways possible. Those were our principles. Out of those 70 measures, there were four or five that were probably highest priority, and one of these was to determine how to reduce the carbon content of the energy that we use in our homes, our businesses, and our industry. The two measures I'm going to describe address that priority. They are the EPS, also known as the PPS, and the carbon CNT. These are not to be confused with the Betsy, the Retsy, or the RES, which I think is also known as the RPS. Everybody still with me here? Good. So I tried the acronyms, and that clearly wasn't going to work, so I was trying to come up with a metaphor. And you know, being male, of course, I started with the military metaphor, and then I went on to the baseball metaphor, and I didn't think either one of those was going
to
fly.
Don't go to caveman.
Yeah, exactly. I tried to come up with something, you know, gender neutral here. So how about a nautical metaphor? The one that works for me, and I'm a sailor, so is that it is worth thinking of the measures you are already looking at, the renewable portfolio standard, the tax credits, the biofuels package. Those are in a sense the wind and the sails. Those are the propulsion. That's what's going to move the ship from where we are right now to where we have to be by 2050. Or actually, we hope those will amplify the energy that the market is already putting in to these kinds of activities that we're engaged in. But a ship needs a navigation system, too, and it needs charts, and sometimes it needs buoys and alarm bells to get where it's going in the safest and the most direct and the most efficient way. That's about all I'm going to do with that one.
Not bad.
Not bad, though. So the two bills that I'm describing are the guidance system. These are the navigation instruments. The first, and I don't even know what the numbers are at this point yet, but the first we would call the emissions performance standard or the power plant performance standard. It simply will direct the state's electric utilities away from investing long-term in more high-risk, high-pollution, low-technology coal plants. It basically says, we've got a bad situation, let's not make it any worse. It sets a standard, or navigation signal if you like, that new supply must not emit more greenhouse gases than an efficient but conventional combined cycle gas plant, about 1,100 pounds per megawatt hour. Gas can meet that standard, renewables can, energy efficiency can, possibly some gasified coal plants may be able to meet that standard. But Oregon ratepayers would not be at further risk, put at further risk of paying to mitigate for new dirty coal plants. This is a provision that has already been adopted in California. One of our West Coast governor's initiative partners has just been adopted by both houses of the Washington legislature and been sent to the governor. And happily, it was adopted in both places by overwhelming votes, but overwhelming bipartisan votes, which is the way this problem ought to be addressed, not on a partisan basis. The second measure, so that's a relatively simple one. That just slows the process down. But by itself, that's not going to achieve any reductions in emissions. It'll just slow the emissions increase rate down. The one that will reverse the course and send us back downhill, we hope, on carbon emissions is a load-based carbon cap-and-trade mechanism. In all its details, it's a pretty complex beast, but it can be reduced to some relatively simple concepts, and at the risk of overreaching my headlights, I've gone ahead and drafted a graphic that tries to describe this. So first, we set a cap on total emissions for each utility or other load-serving entity, but basically utilities. We use emissions levels from a base period that was agreed to in the task force by the utilities as a fair base period, and then the cap declines every 3 years from the current levels of emissions to 10% below 1990 emissions by 2020 and to 75% below 1990 levels by 2050, consistent with the governor's goals. Each utility receives allowances to emit greenhouse gases equal to the base period emissions for the first 3 year period. That's that first horizontal line up on top. And then after 3 years, the line drops, and the utilities again receive allowances, but they don't receive as many allowances. And every 3 years, the number of allowances drops, and it extends from about 2008 or 2009 through 2050. That's a long time, but it is deliberately a long time. It is intended to create a long-term, predictable course for utilities to steer to. Utilities can make resource investment decisions with confidence in that course, with confidence that at least with respect to their carbon choices, you know, those will be considered prudent if they stay within that line. Predictability is a very important risk and therefore cost management factor in utilities resource planning and resource acquisition. Secondly, the task force agreed that all load-serving entities of any significance, not just electric utilities, but also the gas utility and large self-generators, would be asked to comply. We didn't want to create unintended customer shifts from a set of covered utilities to a set of uncovered utilities. And again, the utilities, I think, agreed that that was rational policy. Third, we determined to measure carbon content at the load, that is to say, at the customer level rather than at the generator level. Simple reason, we import a large amount of our electricity, and Montana, Wyoming, you know, take exception to other states regulating plants that are operating within their borders. We can't do that, but we can track where our power comes from. We know how much carbon already, how much carbon is associated with generation from each plant. And so we have a way to, in effect, enforce a reduction of carbon at the load rather than at the generator. Fourth, we wanted to build flexibility into the system, and this is where the necessary complexity enters the picture. This is the Senator Packwood's admonition that you can have a simple tax code or a fair tax code, but you can't have both. This is going to be a little bit like this. You know, we could have a much simpler system, but it would not be a system that takes it takes into consideration the fact that utilities are different, water years are different, conditions are different, and we need something that's flexible enough that it can meet the goal, which is reducing carbon, you know, rather than simply being a harassing regulation that utilities agonized to meet. So we choose not to prescribe how each utility will comply with the cap. It needs to do so in the least cost manner possible. We allow trading of allowances from one covered entity to another so that the party with the lowest carbon reduction cost opportunities can sell those excess reductions to someone who has higher cost opportunities, achieving the same reduction at a net overall lower cost to the state. A utility can reduce beyond its allowances early, and if it does so, it can bank those extra allowances and save them against future requirements, again, adding flexibility to the system. If a utility needs a longer compliance period, if it's got a longer investment plan, it needs a longer period than 3 years, it can extend one up to 6 years if it can make the case to the regulatory utility. We have low hydro years in this region from time to time. When we do, our utilities have to go out and buy power on the market. When they buy power on the market, it's almost always higher carbon power. So we've built into this mechanism the ability to, in effect, extend the compliance, three-year compliance period, another year if we've got a low hydro year in the middle. So we build those and a number of other flexibilities into the design. They are all intended to permit more economically efficient choices, easier compliance, and ultimately lower costs. And that's because the first question that we know is going to be asked of this proposal is, how much is it going to cost? And what's it going to cost consumers? There are several answers to that. I'll restrict myself to three. The first one is to remember, as Bill's presentation, I think, displayed graphically, that there's also a cost to doing nothing and a cost to trying to cope with the consequences of climate change if we don't deal with it. The most authoritative study on this comparison was issued earlier this year by the British government, and you know, roughly speaking, it says that if we don't spend a dollar to try to reduce carbon emissions, we will spend $5 to deal with the consequences of those carbon emissions. It's roughly a 5-to-1 ratio. That's the conservative ratio. It went north from there. Second answer, and this is a little closer to home, is that the task force knew it was going to be asked the question, so we modeled the design that we created. We modeled it for its effects on customer bills. And while all of us would like to continue refining that model, its initial conclusions are pretty intuitive and reinforced by parallel studies. And it basically says that under most likely future load growth conditions, light to medium load growth, the average consumer's bill would actually decline. The consumer's bit rate would go up. And while that seems a little puzzling at first, it's actually very consistent with our history in this region, which is that we're reducing carbon emissions first by investing in energy efficiency. Higher rates are offset by lower consumption, and that drives costs down even as rates can go up. Under higher load growth circumstances, we can see both higher costs and higher rates, but in both cases, either the decreases or the increases are very modest, you know, less than 0.5% of the state's GDP. So there's a third answer, and that is that there is a large opportunity cost to this state and to businesses in this state if we miss this train. I don't know what happened to the nautical metaphor. Sorry. But this is the train to a clean energy future.
We missed the boat.
We missed the boat. missed the train, yeah. But there are going to be opportunities to develop and sell new products and services like the wind projects that PPM Energy, headquartered in Portland, one of the largest companies in the world, develops. Siting services that law firms and engineering firms are already developing and selling across the country. Even completely new products like the green tags that my company develops and sells. So we think we have addressed the cost question. Certainly there are going to be increases in costs as well as cost savings and investment revenue return opportunities. We can't predict those exactly for the next 50 years, but what we can do is try to describe a flexible mechanism that can adjust to different circumstances, you know, different technologies, different cost issues as they come along. How am I doing on time?
You're up. Because we have 8 minutes left, and
then I'm up. Okay. So let me just finish.
You're out of time.
With this, fair enough. I know your legislative plates are very full right now, and you have to be the best judges of whether this issue can be delayed. You've heard from Mark, you've heard from Bill. You know, most of you, I think, already know that the margin for error here is very slender, and the true driver for national action on climate change is running through state capitals today. So we have a disproportionately important role in bringing this country and therefore the whole planet into line in a strategy to reduce the greenhouse gases and meet our goals. Thanks.
Thank you, Angus. Bob, you get to wrap up.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Avakian and committee members. My name is Bob Doppelt, and I direct the Climate Leadership Initiative at the University of Oregon. We're a climate change research and technical assistance program, and I am also a member of the Governor's Climate Change Integration Group. And I am, I guess, the cleanup hitter tonight. My task is sort of to try to come back at full circle to what Secretary of State Bradbury started off with and talk about a little bit why should we care about these bills? Why is it important to change? And that's to move some of this forward. And that's because I'm going to talk a little bit about the economic impacts of climate change and what does it mean for the state. I'm going to start with a global view. Angus just mentioned one of the things I was going to talk about, but then I'll move down and talk briefly about the local and regional level, and I'll skip some of what I was going to talk about for the sake of time. Let me summarize the key points I wanted to make so you get that before you all leave. The first is that we've done two different economic analyses now, one for the governor's office in the state of Washington, looking at the economic impacts of climate change in Washington State. You're getting handed that document now. We did that last year. In 2005, we did a preliminary assessment here in Oregon of the economic impacts of climate change. And in both of those studies, what we found is that the economic effects of climate change are already becoming visible here in Oregon and in Washington, and the impacts are clearly going to grow the warmer it gets. We also found that, as with any constraint, climate change opens the doors to new economic opportunities in low carbon goods and services. And thirdly, what we found is what you've heard from others tonight, is that the cost of not acting to solve this problem are large and could be catastrophic compared to the cost of solving the problem. So let me just quickly tick through some of the findings, but first let me define this issue from an economic perspective. Economically, climate change is considered an externality. And what this means is that the emissions of greenhouse gases imposes a cost on others that the emitter does not bear. When I drive my car down the road, I'm emitting greenhouse gases, but I don't pay the cost of the effect of those gases. Those costs are going to be felt over a long time period and over the whole world, but the exact nature of those costs is very uncertain. It'll be determined on how policies play out in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and also how the climate and ecological systems respond. And perhaps most importantly, those that are most affected by this externality have no say in this process that we're going through here today, which are future generations. And I think that's really important to think about. So with that as a background, a number of researchers have begun to calculate the financial cost to try to put some numbers on these trends that you've been hearing about today, in terms of what climate change will mean. The most authoritative was the study that Angus just talked about. The British government last year released a report led by Sir Nicholas Stern, who's the former chief economist from the World Bank. It provided good news and bad news, and I think both are relevant for Oregon. The bad news is that unless we control greenhouse gas emissions and act very quickly, climate change is likely to impact the global GDP by between 5 and 20% by mid-century, which is essentially at a scale of the Great Depression or World War II. The positive news was that it still is possible to avert the most significant damage. As Secretary Bradbury said, some warming is already in the pipeline, but we think we can avert the most serious if we act quickly. And that the cost of averting that is probably going to be no more than about 1% of global GDP by 2050. This is not insignificant itself, but it's manageable. And especially given that the alternative is likely to be serious depression. The final thing that the Stern report looked at is the economic opportunities that are emerging in climate change because of the need to push towards or develop more carbon neutral products and services. And they projected that there's a $500 billion market that's likely to grow in those fields by mid-century. So we that's as a background. We then looked at the at Washington State and in Oregon, and I'll very quickly summarize some of what we found here. First, what I think you heard from Secretary Bradbury, Secretary of State, was that water is the most common theme that cuts across the economic impacts in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. Think of all the industries and businesses that are connected to or depend on ample supplies of fresh water. From forestry and agriculture to municipal and industrial water water supplies, power production, tourism and recreation, even transportation up and down the Columbia to the Port of Portland is all dependent on ample supplies of fresh water. And as snowpack melts earlier and comes out or is reduced, we'll have less water available in the summers, which impacts those industries. Sea level is another important effect, and that's also water-related. So let me just give you some very brief examples of those impacts. We estimated that by 2050, Oregon farmers are likely to lose about 2.9 million acre-feet of water for irrigation, which is roughly half of what they use today, valued at between $265 million to $995 million. Agriculture will have other effects other than water shortages, such as positive effects like longer growing seasons for some crops, and negative effects relating to increased water demands and possible changes in pests and weeds and crop diseases. One other impact that I'll point out that Bill talked about, the Secretary of State talked about, that assuming the same statistical relationships hold between fire and temperature in this century as they did in the last century, the number of forest acres burned in Oregon and Washington is likely to rise by 50% by the 2020s and by 100% by 2040s. And in Oregon, we projected that meant that the direct cost to the Oregon Department of Forestry for fighting fires is likely to rise to between $60 to $96 million a year by the 2020s, from $40 to $64 now, and to $80 to $128 million by 2040s. A pretty significant increase. BLM and Forest Service costs are likely to rise similarly. I know that I'm out of time. There is a lot more information and details in the testimony that I presented you and the studies that you can look at. I will say that from a fire perspective, fire is likely to become the destructive force here in Oregon and Washington that hurricanes are to the Gulf Coast. And I think that's a very significant effect. I also think that sea level rise is also something that we have to take a significant look at, especially from Florence north, low-lying areas and beaches. Let me close by making 2 points. One is that I think the economic impacts of climate change are going to affect our economy in 4 ways. One is through direct effects on economic output, direct effects on our businesses. The second is we're going to see effects on increased effects on depreciation of equipment. Our infrastructure is going to have to turn over quicker, roads, bridges, etc. Third is we're going to see adverse effects on human health and human skills, and that clearly affects the workforce. And fourth, we'll see cumulative effects that interact within the whole economy. And we're also going to be affected by impacts occurring elsewhere in the national and global economy. So Oregon is not in any way going to be immune from the economic impacts of climate change. In fact, I think we'll be right at the heart of it in many ways. I'm going to close with one optimistic comment, if I may, because I am not all gloom and doom about this issue. I think the historical evidence shows that if we can get our thinking right about this issue and act quickly, that we may end up actually much better off by taking steps now to adjust to climate change than we are today. Climate change is really about a change in the world's energy regimes. And every time the world has gone through a major change in any energy regimes, the world has ended up better off. The first change occurred 230,000 years ago when humans discovered how to use fire. And obviously the ability to cook and stay warm increased human health. The next major shift was from wood and organic material to coal about 200 years ago, and it launched the Industrial Revolution, which just dramatically increased economic well-being. And the most recent major shift was from coal to oil. And then from the direct use of fuels to indirect use through electricity, like we now use in the Pacific Northwest, in the early part of this century. And that spurred wealth creation never before seen on Earth. And I think if we act promptly, do this wisely and correctly, we'll see the same kind of economic benefits from making that transition to a low-carbon economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob and Angus. Appreciate it. Any questions for the panel before we adjourn? Looks like Representative Jensen has a question.
Well, I...
For comment?
I'm just wondering whether you really are serious about, you know, any questions, you know.
I'll let you ask one, Bob.
There's...
And then I'm taking the gavel, Bob.
Representative.
Well, I want to thank everybody for the presentation, if I am allowed the luxury of doing that without angering the chair, that makes no difference to me whatsoever.
It's been a very long day, that's all I'll say.
Madam Chair, I understand the long day sort of thing in this building, but I deeply appreciate the information that has been brought to us. I think it is good information. I, unlike many, or at least some folks, am not quite as negative on this issue of global warming as I guess maybe I might be, but. One of the things that does perplex me as we look at the solutions or how to deal with this, and I made this comment on the House floor, as I understood, the automobile is a major polluter in our society. And I can offer you today a 20% saving tomorrow morning in the amount of pollution that we will get from automobiles without doing anything except changing the signs on our speed limit signs on our freeways and roads. But we're willing to take all sort of and we're venturing out, taking all sorts of new, and in some ways, in some places, uncharted paths to get someplace, but we're not willing to take the stands to do something that is proven, that we know works. Mm-hmm. Now, is that going to be the answer to the whole scenario, reducing this? No, probably not. But it is something that would work, and it's something that, you know, all of the discussions that I'm hearing, other than the radical, anti-environmentalist from Eastern Oregon, the only one making any statements, in that regard. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I could go on a long time on this particular issue, but I use that one, and I'm going to be kind to both chairs here and save them from having an assault charge filed against them, and stop with that. But there are a number of other examples that we could use to make the same point. And in order for me to be enthusiastic about some of the things that people want to do, I have to be willing to have people look at the simple answers and the simple solutions before we do the other thing. And I had one other, and it's just a fleeting comment, and that was a question about Gail when she came up and referred to herself as something of inadequate. And quite frankly, that is the one thing I've never known about Miss Ackerman.
I will second that.
One of the most talented people I've ever known, and so I did have to correct the record on that.
Well, thank you, Representative Jensen. I will second that. And just in response to your comment, before I take Representative Burley's question, two things. One is, I was one of the few members of this body, if you recall, to vote against increasing the speed limit for that very reason, because we did increase it from 55 or 60 to 65.
I applaud you, Madam Chair.
Yes, and?
Boy, did they ask for this one.
Right. But it was overwhelmingly passed by this body. And second, we did pass last session a bill to establish energy efficiency standards for appliances, which passed overwhelmingly. I think it only had 4 no votes in the House. And Senator Avakian now has the companion bill in his committee, which was voted.
Kathleen, it's on its way to your side.
There you go. Voted out of the Senate committee. And that is another element that we can do immediately that has huge impacts on reducing the demands. And then, of course, I've mentioned this before, if we could amend CAFE standards, the efficiency standards for cars, if the states could do that, I think that could be another tool, but we are preempted from doing that by the federal government. But I appreciate your comments. And
yeah. So you see, Representative, we're doing a lot to help you out. All we need now is one vote from that Eastern Oregon radical. I think we can.
We can do it. Would you gentlemen like to make a comment before we take the last question?
Well, I don't think so.
Good thinking.
Probably very wise. We actually all work together very well up here. Representative
Thank
Burley,
you, Madam
another
Chair.
Eastern Oregon.
Eastern Oregon
Central
radical.
Central Oregon,
yeah,
right.
I, first of all, I don't believe Representative Jensen mentioned which way he wanted to see the speed limits changed. But,
depends on who's driving. I mean.
I think Ms. Ackerman knows how I feel about that. My only comment, and this is just obviously just a food for thought, but I'm very anxious to see how we're going to put the cap and trade on the U.S. Forest Service for their emissions from their wildfires. I'm anxious to see how we put that into effect.
We have a secret plan.
I'm anxious to see that. Thanks.
Okay, right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? I know
the most powerful arguments for hydro and more dams and more hydro.
I think I better gavel. I want to thank everybody who came tonight. I'm going to close the informational hearing on climate change. And just a reminder, we will be having hearings on the bill.
Good work.
Close the House Energy and Environment Committee.
Sure.